78 AT&T, east of Route 1, 100 feet north of Jefferson Bridge Road, a special use exception for a telecommunication tower.
You gonna want to swear everyone at once?
Maybe.
I believe there's six.
How many?
Six.
Okay, sure, send them all up.
Go up to be sworn. Anybody that's gonna testify.
I need you each to give your name and address to this lady to my left, and then don't go away.
Okay, my name is Brock, B-R-O-C-K, Riffle, R-I-F-F-E-L. Address is 200 North Warner Road, King of Prussia, PA.
Helen is Zolna.
Z-O-L-N-A, same address.
William McCain, M-C-C-A-I-N. Address is 30111.
L-E-L-A-N-D, Trice, 1003 Mount Herman Road, Salisbury.
Can you all come back in here, please? Share my, you all swear affirm the testimony you're about to give to be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Thank you.
Good evening, members of the board. My name is Pam Scott. I'm here on behalf of AT&T in connection with their application for a special use exception that would permit a 100-foot telecommunications monopole on a property located at 32919 Coastal Highway in Sussex County. This is an application that was before the board in 2009. The application was approved by the board. However, it was overturned on appeal based on procedural issues, that having to do with the failure to post proper notice in connection with the hearing. This is the exact same application that we submitted to you in 2009. As you know, AT&T is a provider of personal communication services throughout Delaware. They are here because they have a gap in their coverage in the Bethany Beach area, specifically the area that is bounded by 2nd Street and Short Road and along Route 1 in Bethany Beach. We are here asking for a special use exception because of the fact that the code requires that if you have a commercially zoned property for which you would like to install the monopole, but you will not be 500 feet distant from residentially zoned property, requires that you ask the board for a special use exception. That is pursuant to Article 25, Section 194.2 of the Sussex County Code. The code has some additional requirements with respect to this type of application, and we will touch upon those requirements as we submit testimony to the board. The property is zoned commercial. It's about 1.35 acres in size. We are proposing, in connection with the application, we have submitted a number of documents to the board in advance as part of our application, so I assume you have seen those. Essentially, what we have submitted is that there are no existing structures within a 2-mile radius that can be used for co-location purposes. We have submitted documentation that we have a significant gap in our coverage in this area of Bethany Beach. We have submitted information showing that the monopole, as required by your code, is designed so that it will accommodate at least two other carriers. We also have submitted information that shows that the setback from all property lines for this monopole will be at least one-third of the height of the tower. In this case, that would be 33.3 feet. Again, a requirement of your code. That the on-ground equipment and the tower itself will be surrounded by a six-foot-tall fence. And the monopole will have the warning lights at 50-foot intervals as required by your ordinance as well. I would note that the tower that we're talking about this evening is 100 feet in height, which is well below the 150-foot height that is permitted by your code. I'd like to call my first witness. That would be Tom Zolna. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Tom Zolna.
And by whom are you employed?
AT&T.
And what is it that you do for AT&T?
I locate sites for AT&T.
So essentially, you are the person that goes out and finds the real estate where AT&T would locate its monopoles or find existing structures for antennas. Is that correct?
Correct.
And how long have you been doing that for AT&T? Or how long have you been doing that in the industry?
Oh, in the industry, in excess of 20 years.
In connection with our particular application this evening, you were charged to find a location within the area of Bethany Beach where there is a gap in coverage. Is that correct?
Correct.
And were you given some parameters about where it was that you needed to look?
Yes, I was.
And what were those parameters?
Well, basically, the RF engineer does a computer model of the system and gives me what we call a search area. And I have a handout here for the board members. Basically, the search area extends from somewhere between 2nd and 3rd Street in Bethany Beach down throughout Bethany Beach to approximately Short Road, and from the bay to approximately Kent Avenue going east and west.
And that's identified on the map that you just submitted to the board?
First page.
And once the identified search ring has been provided to you, then what is your process at that point?
Well, basically, I have to go out and find a site. I do that a number of ways. One way is to drive the area, looking for potential sites, talking to people, talking to local officials, and just trying to find a site. The second page of the handout I gave you is a map. It's a little bit larger, and it shows the approximately 33 different sites that I looked at in the course of this process. Pages after that, there's approximately 25 of them or so, are letters that I've written to different landlords trying to find somebody who wants to work with AT&T. And the page after that is tax map. That's how I get information on who the landowners are and things like that. And of course, the last page is the actual landowner that I found and some of his information so that I can write the letters and try to find a site.
Let's talk a little bit about the various properties that you have identified as potential sites for AT&T. A majority of them, although not all, appear to be in the search ring. Is that correct?
Correct.
And why is it that you looked at some outside of the search ring?
Well, basically because I was having trouble finding properties inside the search ring, and I didn't want to just limit the search to the search ring itself, but I wanted to see if there was any potential if I went slightly outside the search ring.
And if you did find something outside of the search ring that was a potential site, you would then need to have the radio frequency engineer review it to see if it would actually work. Is that correct?
Correct. I would write a report, and the radio frequency engineer would look at it specifically to see if it could work for our system.
What about the possibility of existing structures within your search ring that could serve for purposes of antennas?
Well, I, of course, approached the town of Bethany Beach. As a matter of fact, I think there's letters in that package that are addressed to the town of Bethany Beach. And I approached the fire department, and I approached the water company. In the course of doing that, I received some letters back from Bethany Beach. Basically, the town wrote me back on March 2nd, 2005, saying they had no interest in working with us on cellular antennas on their water tower. And they wrote us back on January 31st, 2011, once again. Well, actually, they wrote this letter to the Sussex County Board of Adjustment that they basically don't want to work with us on the on trying to solve our problem. And then the last part was they had a meeting where they once again considered and rejected working with us on the water.
The meeting that you referred to, is that a more recent meeting that took place?
Yes.
What about, for example, tall buildings within your search ring?
Well, the only real set of tall buildings are the Sea Colony buildings, the condo buildings, and I talked with them a number of times during the course of this process. And all the times I talked to them, they did not want to work with us. They don't want antennas on their buildings.
They currently do have some antennas on their structures, correct?
They do. They appear to be antennas for radio communication, like maintenance radio or something like that. But there are no cellular antennas on their buildings.
So it was your understanding, it's your understanding from those conversations that they simply are not interested in having cellular carriers on their buildings?
Correct.
In connection with the site that ultimately was determined to be the best site for this application, is that located sort of centrally in your search ring? Is that correct?
Well, it slightly to the south of central. It's labeled Pepper and Steiner Raw Land, and it's the BP gas station, Arby's restaurant, and convenience mart property. It's located in Sussex County, and it's a little south of Bethany Beach.
And after you located that site, you then worked with the RF engineer to determine whether, in fact, that would suit AT&T's purposes in filling the gap?
Yes, I wrote a report on it, and the RF engineer approved the site, and I entered into a long-term lease with Mr. William Pepper and of Pepper and Steiner to rent some land in the rear of the property for AT&T.
Thank you. I don't have any further questions for Mr. Zolna, in case the board does.
Mr. Burrell, a point of order, if I may.
Robert Witzel for Sea Pine Village. Mr. Burrell, do I have the opportunity to ask questions of the board of Mr. Zolna at this time, or would you prefer that we ask those questions later?
We would typically do that at the conclusion of the applicant's case.
Thank you.
Where should I put this?
Close to the mic, or if you want to use them, can you flip one of those mics around so he can talk into it? Whichever you prefer.
Put it here so everyone can see that.
Did you want to talk? You can use this if you want.
And you can even talk.
I have a copy.
Can you give them my bag?
You gotta talk from here or from there? Okay. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Sure, my name is Brock Riffle.
And by whom are you employed?
AT&T Wireless.
And what is it that you do for AT&T?
I'm tasked with the network design of AT&T system throughout Delaware, New Jersey, parts of Maryland, and Pennsylvania.
And when I referred with Mr. Zolna to the radio frequency engineer, is that the role that you play?
Yes, it is. Actually, this search ring's been available, I think, for over 8 years or 9 years. So it has actually went through a number of engineers. I'm currently the engineer responsible for it. I was also the engineer back before you in 2009.
And could you just give us a little bit of your educational and professional background, please?
Sure. I have a Bachelor's of Science in Electrical Engineering from Drexel University. I have roughly 15 years worth of design experience in radio frequency network design with Verizon, AT&T, and Clearwire. I've testified before boards such as yourself or other municipalities in roughly 300 hearings across New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, and Pennsylvania.
I guess the most obvious question here is why is it that AT&T needs to have a location in this particular area of Sussex County?
Sure. AT&T has a mandate from the FCC to provide reliable service to their customers throughout their licensed area. This portion of Sussex County is one of those areas that AT&T has a wireless license in. Additionally, in this area, AT&T currently is not providing reliable service to its customers. There is roughly a 2-mile long gap from north to south along Route 1, centered near the town of Bethany Beach, where AT&T currently is not providing reliable service to its customers.
And is that what you're showing on the first map that you have here?
First map I have here is labeled at the bottom, AT&T's existing service. There's a number of things going on here. The first thing I'll point out, the same on all the maps, is the scale on the bottom, and I can help with that if anyone has a question about distance. Additionally, there are four major colors. The first and easiest is light blue. That's the ocean and the bay, respectively. The next color would be a dark blue. That dark blue is where AT&T currently has reliable in-building service. The next color is the green, and that is currently where AT&T has reliable in-car service. And left last would be white, and that is where AT&T currently has unreliable either in-car or in-building service for their customers. The reason it's denoted, or I denoted it both as in-building and in-car, is because obviously AT&T's customers, especially now more than ever, are using their phones in homes, in stores, in restaurants, as well as while driving, as well as while outside on the beaches, walking the streets, etc. So as you can see, as illustrated from the prediction study that I have here, that was done using a industry standard prediction software, AT&T has, again, as mentioned, roughly a 2-mile gap in service centered around the proposed location. So I should point out right where I'm pointing to, which is the center of the map, That's our proposed location that we're discussing this evening. There's also other pie wheel artifact shaped devices, or symbols rather, not devices, on the map. And they're labeled, and they denote where AT&T currently has other communications facilities. So for instance, AT&T has a facility labeled Fenwick Towers to the south. They also have a facility to the southwest labeled Ocean View. They also have a facility to the west labeled Beaver Dam. They have a facility to the northwest labeled Millville. And they have a facility to the south labeled Sussex Shore Water Tower. All the sites mentioned, with the exception of the proposed, are being used in this prediction study to show you exactly where AT&T has and does not have reliable service today.
Now, your next map that you prepared, if you could share that with the board.
Sure. The next map is entitled AT&T Complaints. It's labeled down on the lower left-hand side. All the other colors have remained the same. It's still showing AT&T's gap in service. However, I performed a search through AT&T's system throughout 2010 and pulled the complaints that people sent in on their phones. Each one of those red dots represents an AT&T customer that contacted AT&T and complained about their service. Each time that they made a complaint, the phone actually sends in a geocoded location of where that complaint was sent. So I know exactly where those complaints came from, by who, and when. Additionally, they put a comment in the complaint such as no coverage, no data speed, dropped calls, could not make a call, call fail. The predominance of complaints were due to poor coverage. As you can see, most of the AT&T complaints correlate to the area that I signified as being unreliable. It just speaks to the fact that the complaints are one thing that AT&T uses to determine where and when they need to provide a communications facility to enhance their reliable service.
And this essentially corresponds with your own studies that you did to determine where there is a gap in coverage, correct?
That's correct.
And would you like to share your next map?
Sure. Please? The next map is entitled AT&T's Proposed Service. We've kept everything exactly the same in the prediction study. However, we've now turned on or activated the proposed facility to show the reliable service levels that would be provided if, in fact, we were approved to construct the telecommunications facility that we're discussing this evening. As you can see, the proposed facility would provide an abundance of both in-building and in-car coverage. Specifically, the proposed facility would provide strong, reliable in-building coverage to the area of downtown Bethany, which has all of the retail shops, restaurants. Additionally, the residences that go along there, as well as the commercial properties that head down along Route 1. Additionally, the whole service area that previously had a gap in coverage is also filled with reliable in-car service. So AT&T customers can make and receive a phone call a high percentage of the time in all of the areas that are highlighted with the green coverage.
In terms of the proposed site, how was it determined that a 100-foot tower is essentially the height that AT&T needed in this particular instance?
There's several things that go into that, one being the RF engineer's experience, two being the prediction tool that we use. It takes into account the terrain or the ground level throughout the area that we're investigating. It also takes into account the clutter and clutter types. So clutter referring to trees, how tall they are, what type of trees they are, because that's important. Are there houses in the area? Are there commercial properties in the area? All of those different clutter types attenuate radio frequency differently. So the tool takes into account how the clutter in the area actually lessens the signal as the signal travels through the air and through and around these different clutter types. In doing so, the RF engineer will investigate the minimum height necessary to provide the level of reliable service to the area of the objective that they're trying to cover. As such, the predominant issue in this area would be tree clutter, housing clutter, and retail and commercial clutter, because the terrain is relatively flat, so the terrain isn't really playing too much of a role, where more so the trees in the area and the other clutter that the signal has to travel through is. So one of the plots that I put together just to highlight the height issue and describe the fact that the technology we're using today is basically a line of sight technology. Our antennas have to be able to essentially see where the phone is, and the phone has to be able to have line of sight back to the antenna. So basically, this is a path profile that I took from the exact location where the proposed facility would be, and I profiled it to the intersection of Route 26 and Atlantic. So as you can see, on the x-axis, we have a distance marker. So that distance on that path profile was roughly a half a mile. On the y-axis, we have height. So you can see that the height that the proposed facility at is listed at 100 feet. And then you have a dotted line that basically goes from the antennas down to a one-and-a-half, two-story residence or store or restaurant that's at that location. Then you have an area in green, which is basically the tree clutter. So in order for our antennas to see down through the tree clutter and to the phones when they're on a first floor or second floor of a building, that's why we need the height to be a minimum of 100 feet to basically see the phones. That is obviously a simplistic viewpoint of it, but the very complex tool takes into account all of the different parameters that are used to verify that this is correct.
So an option would not be, for example, two 50-foot towers or four 25-foot towers or something like that. Is that correct?
That's correct. The difficulty with that is the trees in this area are, you know, upwards of 60 feet, 65 feet. And any time that you now take your antennas and stick them in that tree canopy line, your signal has to go directly through that. So it's the same as if, I duck down below this bench here and try to talk to you. You wouldn't hear me as well as if when I'm up and I have clear sight of you.
What about one of the things that Mr. Zoln and I talked about was the possibility of co-locating, in other words, putting antennas on existing structures.
Yep.
And Mr. Zoln indicated that he could not find anything suitable within the search ring. Is that something we can further discuss in terms of your efforts?
Yes, there were some existing structures that would be suitable, and when I say they would be suitable, they're suitable from a real estate perspective, meaning the landlord was willing to work with AT&T if it was a site that could fulfill AT&T's radio frequency needs. There were three existing lattice towers that are in the two-mile radius. Additionally, there was one water tank that's in the area. All three of those, from a real estate perspective, were available to AT&T, and it's then the radio frequency's job, my job, to go in and see if those existing structures can fulfill the objectives that AT&T is looking to do in those areas.
So, and do you have some maps that show that?
I do.
You could share?
So this first one is entitled AT&T Service with ATC2. ATC just refers to a tower company. Their name is American Tower Company. So there was actually three towers that American Tower owns in the area. I just have these out of order. So there's one, two, and three, but two just happened to come up first. So essentially the existing facility, existing tower, labeled ATC2 is now shown on the map. It's roughly 3/4 mile to the southwest of our existing Beaver Dam site. In this prediction study, I have it activated. along with the other sites that AT&T currently has in the area with their existing coverage. So I'm showing what coverage, reliable coverage, would come from using AT&T's existing network along with the existing structure that American Tower owns labeled ATC2. As you can see, there's still a large gap in coverage. Effectively, the site ATC2 is further away from one of our existing sites. So obviously, it provides mostly redundant coverage with what we already have and does not provide anything new to the area that the objective is in. You still have a large gap in coverage. The next prediction study is titled AT&T Service with ATC1. It's another existing lattice tower owned by American Tower. And that is actually just across the street, probably a tenth of a mile from our Beaver Dam site. It's a large guide tower. There's like a red and white pole. And again, since it's such close proximity to our Beaver Dam site, it provides mostly redundant coverage. It does not provide much new coverage, especially to the objective area up and down Route 1, as well as Route 26, as well as the downtown Bethany, all of the beach areas, the residential and commercial areas that AT&T is trying to cover. The third American Tower site labeled ATC3 is again roughly 3/4 mile due south of our existing Beaver Dam site. So again, it provides mostly redundant coverage. However, it does provide new coverage to the south. However, that is not the objective area that we're trying to cover with the proposed facility. ATC3 does not provide any new reliable service to the residential or commercial areas of the objective area for AT&T. The next plot is entitled AT&T Service with SBWT, just an acronym for South Bethany Water Tank. That location is roughly 3/4 mile south of our proposed facility. With this prediction study, we're again showing what our AT&T's existing network looks like along with the addition of the South Bethany water tank. As you can see, the South Bethany water tank does improve AT&T service through the area. However, there's several big gaps left in service. Number one, we have a gap of roughly 3/4 mile to the north along Route 1 and just north of the town of Bethany, where there is no reliable in-car service. Additionally, there is no reliable in-building service to the downtown area of Bethany, where all of the resident or restaurants, commercial properties, and as well as the residences in that area. So anyone trying to make and receive a call inside of one of those stores, inside of one of those restaurants, inside of one of those homes will have difficulty and it will be unreliable.
And the way you come about preparing all of these maps is a standard process that's used in the industry, is that correct?
Yes, it is. It's done using an industry standard tool. It's actually the most popular in the industry. As I said before, it takes into account terrain values throughout this whole area that we're looking at. It also takes into account the height of the antennas. It takes into account what type of antenna, what power level it's using, and the direction that it's also pointing as well.
So at the end of the day, where we are is essentially the monopole that we're proposing is what fills our significant coverage gap. Is that correct?
Correct. My job at AT&T is to provide AT&T's customers with reliable service throughout their AT&T's licensed footprint, and to do that with the best design possible using the least amount of facilities. And I believe that the monopole does that.
Thank you.
Sure.
I have a question, Mr. Reber. couple, actually. What does your competition do to provide coverage in that area?
I'm not privy to exactly what all of our competitors do. However, my opinion or my assumption would be that they're on relatively many of the same facilities that we are on, and they've also probably are not on many of the facilities that Tom mentioned earlier that we tried to go on, such as Sea Colony. I believe probably AT&T's major competitor in this area is on the South Bethany water tank. I believe they're on the Northern Sussex Shore water tank. And then, like I said before, I would assume they're probably on similar existing structures that AT&T's on today as well.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that AT&T is mandated by the FCC to fulfill coverage. In the event that that doesn't happen for whatever reason, then what happens? What recourse does FCC have, or what penalties does that cause the AT&T?
There's different levels, I guess, of penalties, per se. AT&T has to cover a certain percentage of the population in each area, and they also have to cover a certain percentage of the geographical area. I'm not exactly sure of what those monetary penalties are, but I do know that in the license it does stipulate, you know, if you do not comply with these, the FCC can come back. I'm assuming they would give you a warning, and then the FCC would also work with the carrier to try and figure out what, if any, solutions were possible. And I assume that would go to a court.
Okay. So the FCC could possibly even force an antenna somewhere.
That's possible.
The FCC would get involved before restricting or taking away the AT&T's license for that area?
Again, this is just an assumption. I'm not an expert in this field, the legality or how the FCC interacts with AT&T. However, my assumption would be that they would first give AT&T a warning and figure out how to solve the problem.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
I have one question. You got a 100-foot tower. Why not a 150-foot tower to make sure you have the coverage?
Again, my job as a RF engineer is to give AT&T their best solution, but at the same time, I have to balance that with the rest of the criteria in every municipality, meaning it's typical in all the municipalities that I work with that they would like you to use the minimum height necessary, so you're not just taking your antennas and putting them up as high as you want. Additionally, in some instances, increased height isn't necessarily a good thing. In this area, if you put up your antennas 150, 200 feet, the signal will carry even further. Since there's a very large density of customers that AT&T has in this area, they actually need each facility to only cover a smaller area, meaning maybe a mile and a half or 2 mile in radius, versus putting antennas up 200 feet and trying to cover a 2 to 3 mile radius, and that's because AT&T just has a very, very large customer base, and they can't use taller towers to cover larger footprints or areas. So,
what's the range of the 100-foot tower?
The range?
Miles? Yeah.
As I said, I think in this case, based on this area, the flat terrain and the clutter, roughly a mile and a half of reliable service.
And that would get the coverage for you?
Yes.
Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Reaver, am I understanding that more users would require more towers?
The short answer is yes. The amount of users a particular facility can handle is capped based on
how many radios they can put in there and how much wireless spectrum they have. In this case, we feel that one facility to cover the footprint that we're talking about at 100 feet is adequate for the foreseeable future, if it's in the correct location, which is where we feel this proposed facility is.
So if you moved it down farther, you could might have to go higher up then. I mean, if it got a different area than what it is right now?
Correct. If it's like a puzzle. If you took the puzzle piece out and tried to move it around, you may have to go taller. You may have to add an additional facility. For example, if we took this 100-foot monopole and we moved it down a mile to the south, just for instance, I'm not saying that that's what we're looking to do, that would definitely move the puzzle piece south and open up a gap in service to the north. And that's where we would probably have to add an additional facility to the north. That's why it's crucial to find the correct location the first time so that you can fill that puzzle hole with just one puzzle piece.
Thank you.
One quick question. What would the height of the South Bethany water tower be if you were to?
For my prediction study that I used here, I ran it at 138 feet, and that was based on the fact that I believe, as I mentioned earlier, Verizon is at 148 feet on that water tank.
Okay, thank you.
And that's an assumption that we could actually locate there.
Meaning you don't know if you can or not, but assuming
correct.
That you can.
It was just an assumption that I made.
Okay.
One more quick thing. In the letters that were mailed to the prospective tenants by Mr. Zalna, mm-hmm. I noticed that some of them list different size poses, and I assume from what you've been saying is that depending on the location of their property, that's why.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
State your name for the record, please.
My name is Kenneth R. Foster, F-O-S-T-E-R.
And Dr. Foster, what is it that you do for a living?
I'm a professor of bioengineering at the University of Pennsylvania, but I'm here as a private consultant and not representing the university.
You've actually been retained by AT&T to review the radio frequency emissions associated with this installation.
Correct.
Determine whether or not they comply with the FCC standards, correct?
Yes.
In that regard, could you let the board know what it is that you reviewed and what your conclusions are?
Okay, I reviewed a report that I believe was initially submitted with this application, a report by David C. Cotton, Jr. Of SiteSafe, dated August 2009. That is an analysis using standard methods of the levels of public exposure to radio waves from the site. It's based upon engineering data for the site, and it uses a calculation method that is specified by the Federal Communications Commission to determine maximum levels of human exposure to RF energy. To make a long story short, the report states that the maximum exposure that any member of the public would receive from the site is a tiny fraction of FCC limits, less than 1% of FCC limits. I reviewed this report, confirmed the calculations, and I agree with it completely.
Could you tell us a little bit, or tell the board maybe a little bit, about your background and experience in this particular area over the years?
I have a PhD in physics. I'm also a registered professional engineer in Pennsylvania. Since 1971, I've been doing research on medical uses, possible health risks of electromagnetic fields, including radio frequency energy. I'm a member of a national committee that sets exposure limits for radio frequency energy, which actually are the ones that inform the FCC limits. Published more than 100 papers and related areas. I've been a consultant to a number of companies and national and international agencies related to health risks of electromagnetic fields.
And essentially, as the rules go for the FCC, if in fact the carrier can show that the emissions level are below the FCC standard, that satisfies whatever test there is, and there can be no further review of that question at the local level.
Yes, well, that's a legal judgment. That's my understanding of the state of affairs.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you, sir.
I'm not sure this witness was sworn in because he arrived late. So, Mary, you want to be sworn in, please? But Mr. Burrow.
What's your name and address, please?
Mario, M-A-R-I-O, Calabretta, C-A-L-A-B-R-E-T-T-A, 900 South Lewis, L-E-W-I-S, Lewis Road, Royers Ford, R-O-Y-E-R-S, F-O-R-D, Pennsylvania, 19468.
Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give would be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Just again, could you state your name for the record, please?
Mario Calabretta.
And by whom are you employed?
I'm a consultant to Velocitel Incorporated for the preparers of the plan.
And could you give the board a little idea of your professional and educational background, please?
Sure. I have a Master's of Civil Engineering degree from the University of Maryland. I've been working in the telecommunications industry for almost 12 years. I've worked on upwards of 1,000 sites. A variety of which include water tanks, buildings, stealth applications, as well as raw land or what we consider new builds like this facility.
And in connection with this particular application, there were a set of plans that were submitted to the board, basically showing the layout of the site and the proposed location of the monopole. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And is that what you have in front of us?
Yes, I have a plan dated 3/16/10, which shows the overall parcel in question, as well as details involved.
Could you just sort of orient the board to where this site is located in terms of the major roadways, and then specifically where we are proposing to locate the monopole?
Sure. The parcel itself is just off of Coastal Highway. There is currently a gas station along with a food establishment currently operating on that facility. It's just over an acre in size. Coastal Highway, of course, runs on the north south axis, and the property itself, where we intend to locate the facilities, to the rear of that parcel, so due east of the actual building itself. What AT&T proposes is a fenced compound, which will enclose an equipment shelter as well as the monopole itself. The equipment shelter is 11 feet 6 inches wide and 20 feet long. The monopole itself, which I'll get to in another page, is 100 feet tall, and AT&T proposes to mount its antennas at the top of that structure. The access will be utilizing the existing driveway that's already there, so we don't propose any new access drives or any new paving. The fence compound itself will have a portion of its compound graded with stone, so no impervious surfaces. The actual shelter itself will be raised up on piers, so there is access even underneath the actual shelter itself. So it's a very minimal increase in terms of impervious area or actual cover to the actual grade itself. As I mentioned before, the monopole itself is 100 feet tall. AT&T proposes initially 9 antennas to be mounted at the top of that structure, up to a total of possibly 12. So they are reserving 3 antennas for future use if that need would ever be required. The antennas themselves are connected to the equipment shelter via coaxial cables, very similar to cable TV, that kind of cable, just a lot larger, about 2 inches in diameter. Those coaxial cables run inside the tubular structure itself. The monopole is comprised of a faceted tubular steel hollow tube, in essence. So the cables run inside that tube, so they're not visible on the outside, and exit via ports at the very top of the structure to access the antennas, and at the very base of the structure to access the shelter itself. So the coaxial cables run from the antennas into the shelter itself, and the shelter is what houses the actual radio equipment, the equipment that actually allows the cell site to function and to run. That's generally the overall proposal, and just for clarity's sake, the antennas themselves are 72 inches tall, about 6 feet tall, roughly the configuration of a shoebox, just a very long shoebox.
Could we go back to the prior plan? If you could point out to the board the setbacks from the property lines in terms of location of the monopole.
Sure. From the front of the property line, which would be due west, we are 242 feet away from the front property line. The northernmost property line, we are set back 98 feet to the center of the pole. The eastern property line, the rear of the property, would be 118 feet to the center of that pole. And the southernmost property line would be 71 feet to the center of the monopole.
And these setbacks are actually in excess of what is required by the code in terms of one-third the height of the tower.
That is correct.
Can you talk a little bit about the monopole itself and what specifications are used in terms of its construction and how it withstands wind speeds, et cetera?
Sure. The pole itself, as I mentioned before, is a hollow tubular structure, very similar in configuration as many of the light standards you might see along interstate highways that hold up those large lights and interchanges, et cetera. Some of the same manufacturers actually produce those structures as well as these. So it's a hollow steel tubular structure. At its base is a large caisson, which is basically a large pier that's usually drilled straight down into the ground. It can vary in diameter from 4 to 6 feet, maybe even larger depending on soil conditions. That's the caisson itself. The tube itself, as I mentioned before, is a faceted steel tubular structure. It varies in width at the base from anywhere from 4 to 5 feet, depending on height, and will taper. It's actually not a straight tube. It will taper, get smaller as it goes up, essentially finishing usually somewhere around 2 to 3 feet in diameter based on the ultimate design. As far as design goes, these particular kinds of structures are regulated by national codes. Those codes govern all telecommunications structures made out of steel for the entire United States. The current code is the EIA-TIA code, which is the Electronics Industry Association and Telecommunications Industry Association code 222-G. That is the most up-to-date code, and it tells us as engineers what wind speeds, ice accumulation, et cetera, are required for every county in the United States. In this particular case for Sussex County and the location that we're proposing this facility, that wind speed that we have to design to is 120 miles an hour. That assumes a certain speed based on landscape, terrain, et cetera, but it also includes very significant safety factors. So frankly, we design these things up to that limit, but that doesn't mean that at that limit the structure for any reason would fail. There are factors of safety that are built into these structures, very much like a building, like the building we're in. It's designed to the same kinds of codes, different code, but it's all designed by codes that are established, and that's what the engineer has to deal with in this particular case. You know, the roof trusses on this building or the roof would have to withstand a certain amount of snow load. The building facade would have to withstand a certain amount of wind load. Engineers don't choose that criteria. That's basically determined for us by these national organizations, and in a like manner, these codes have been determined for this area, and we don't have any choice. We couldn't design to a lower standard even if we wanted to.
And this particular monopole will also be designed to accommodate at least two other carriers. Is that correct?
Correct. Given a number of carriers in existence today, most monopoles, frankly, are designed for up to five carriers. That's not unusual. The ordinance requires at least two additional carriers, so this will be designed for a minimum of three. But it's not much trouble, frankly, to design for even a higher capacity in terms of numbers of carriers.
And the equipment on the ground will be fenced with
correct.
A 6-foot tall fence, is that correct?
Correct. There is a chain link fence which will surround the compound itself, minimum of 6 feet tall as the ordinance requires.
And we also have lighting at 50-foot intervals for this monopole, correct?
Yes, there is a requirement for lighting. It is 100 feet tall, so there will be lighting at the 50-foot mark and at the very, very top of the structure at 100 feet.
I got a question. The pole, with salt and water, is it a different type of pole you're going to put down there? I mean, with the salt and everything? Would it bother this pole?
I'm sorry.
Salt from the water and the air and stuff?
The poles themselves are galvanized to inhibit rusting. In situations like this where the actual water isn't in contact with the structure itself, I mean, it's elevated, there wouldn't be any special requirement for that. The coatings that are on the structure itself protect it from corrosion.
How about the box? Say, it's right next to the ocean, it had flood or something coming there. Is that all sealed?
The shelter itself is raised above flood level. So if there was any water that would actually inundate this site, it would remain above it. So we are 18 inches above what the FEMA study has determined to be the worst case height of that.
So you're 18 inches above that?
We're 18 inches above the actual flood, correct. The flood elevation here is 7.8 feet. The ground elevation is 6.7. Our floor elevation is at 9.3, so 1.5 feet above the flood, which is almost 3 feet above the actual ground level.
Is the tower the same way above is it right even with the ground, or is it up higher?
Well, the caisson itself is usually about a foot above grade. It has no bearing if it was under a couple feet of water for X number of days in terms of its actual capacity. What we would worry about with the shelter, of course, that we have very sensitive electronic equipment inside of it. We would want to keep the water out of it for that reason. But the tower itself could be in water for several days at a time, and it wouldn't have any effect. It's not large enough to be concerned about impeding flow. We're not anywhere near a floodway where actually waters are flowing past the unit. It's not necessary. The caisson could be built up higher if it was required, but I wouldn't see any technical reason to do that.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could you state your name for the record, please?
Leland Trice.
And by whom are you employed?
The Trice Group.
And what is the Trice Group?
We're a real estate appraisal company doing business in Maryland, Delaware, and Virginia.
And could you give the board a sense of your professional and educational background, please?
I have an economics degree from the University of Maryland. I've been in the appraisal industry, since 1985. I'm a certified general appraiser in Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. I'm also a licensed real estate broker in Maryland. I'm designated by the Appraisal Institute and by the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors, and I've been qualified in a number of courts as an expert witness.
You were retained by AT&T to do a review of the impact of the proposed monopole on real estate values in the area, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Can you describe to the board what type of analysis you performed to make a determination about the impact?
We did a market study to look for any evidence of value impairment to properties in reasonable proximity to the monopole. At the request of our client, we focused our analysis on Sussex County, and specifically we look for more recent monopole construction in Sussex County. We identified a few other recent monopole construction sites, but we found insufficient quantity of sales data to produce any results. So we focused our efforts on this Bethany Beach site. We actually had the benefit, because there is a temporary monopole on the site, we had the benefit of analyzing sales data that occurred before and after the construction of that pole. And since this situation has attracted some press attention, we also had the benefit of, in this analysis, identifying whether that actual coverage itself had any impact, and that would be captured in our study. So using kind of industry conventions, we looked at sales data that occurred within a 2,000-foot radius of the monopole. We looked back a year prior to the monopole construction and we looked at sales a year after the monopole construction. That search yielded 34 transactions. Of those 34 transactions, we were able to use 10 sales and construct what's known in our industry as matched pairs. Matched pairs are properties, two properties that have sold that are very similar in most respects. In this case, the matched pairs we used were properties, again, one of the pairs would have sold before this pole was constructed, one would have sold after the pole was constructed. Sea Pines is the closest residential project. However, only one sale in our study period prior to that pole occurred. That was a bank foreclosure sale. So we did not use that in our analysis. We thought that was unsuitable. We have also since reviewed a rental study of Sea Pines units prepared by Mr. McCain, who will be appearing here shortly, which demonstrates no evidence of rental income impairment or negative reaction from renters. So the immediate market area around this pole is what I would characterize as a typical seaside resort market. Fairly high density and mixed use. Within close proximity of this pole is a fairly diverse mix of residential dwellings, convenience store, hotel, restaurants, retail. There are also power lines that run on both sides of this pole that are in very close proximity to residences and other dwellings. And we have some, should we hand out our reports to the council?
I think the report has been handed out to the members.
And there are some photographic exhibits in that report which show the skyline from various angles so you can see what a resident or a customer in the area would see from various directions. And in summary, the results of our analysis at looking at these various sets of pairs showed no evidence of impairment.
And in terms of the properties that you looked at, a number of your matched pairs were Sea Colony, is that correct?
Yes, we had Sea Colony, we had some single family dwellings.
And basically, in terms of reviewing the matched pair, you determine whether there was anything significant other than the location of the tower that it would have any impact on the sales price?
We really tried to reduce the variable to time so that we found two properties that have sold with the primary difference being transaction occurring before and transaction occurring after the pole. Could we discern whether the market was discounting property values after the pole, and we couldn't find any. We found some sales that sold higher, some sales that sold lower, not a significant variance in either direction.
So in conclusion, then, your determination is that there is no adverse impact associated with the properties by the location of this
correct.
We monopole.
We could find no data to support that.
Just to give the board, I guess, an idea, I guess here's a set of pictures from your report that's showing the tower and
yes,
some of the...
Yes, this is page 9, and looking at kind of facing the eastern direction, you can see various uses, and the monopole is no higher, frankly, than the power lines adjacent to it.
Temporary pole, how high is that?
It's 80 feet.
80 feet?
Correct.
That utility pole is how high?
I do not know the exact height of that pole.
Is this a this type of match paired analysis that you did? Is this an accepted analysis in your industry when you're looking at this type of a variable in terms of impact on property values?
It is.
something that's also done in connection, for example, with high-tension power lines, et cetera?
Yes, it's if there were a higher quantity of data, we could get into regression analysis and some more some other statistical tools. We just don't have enough quantity of data to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, William McCain.
And by whom are you employed?
W.R. McCain and Associates.
And what is W.R. McCain and Associates?
We're a comprehensive real estate valuation firm located offices in Salisbury, Maryland, and Ocean View, Delaware.
And what is your professional and educational background?
I am a licensed real estate appraiser. I'm a certified general real estate appraiser in the states of Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. My educational background is I have an economics degree from Washington College, and I also have a master's of business administration degree from the Purdue School of Business at Salisbury University. I've been in the real estate valuation field for 25 years, and I also have the MAI designation with the Appraisal Institute. That's the highest level of designation offered internationally. And I've been qualified numerous times in courts across Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia for expert witness cases.
Were you retained by AT&T to consider the impact of the proposed monopole on property values in the area?
Yes, I was.
And in terms of reviewing that impact, did you do an analysis similar to what Mr. Trice commented on when he was testifying?
We conducted an independent market study to look at the effects on real estate values. We actually took a little bit different approach.
Could you explain to the board what it is that you looked at?
Sure. Basically, what we did was the extent of our valuation of a project encompassed a two-part study. We looked at a review, first of all, of existing national and international research on this topic. And secondly, we then looked at, did a comparative analysis of regional sales data of residential properties that have a closed view or located adjacent to communication towers. The first step in this process was looking at the national and international research. Primarily, that literature was taken from the appraisal journal published by the Appraisal Institute. Also, there's a lot of information provided by the Right-of-Way magazine published by the International Right-of-Way Association. Both of these sources are highly respected in the industry regarding valuation and real estate appraisals. After a thorough search, we found several articles published regarding communication towers. There's actually much more information provided on high voltage transmission lines, which is a little bit more prevalent. But we actually looked at those as well as just the information on communication towers. One of the things that was observed is there's a perception often involved with communication towers and high voltage transmission lines of a perceived loss in value. So we looked at these studies to see objectively if these perceptions came to bear. What we found when we looked at the national data, and I'm not going to go through each individual study. I mean, they're in the reports, but I can summarize those for you. One of the first ones that we were looking at was by a Dr. Sandy Bond. This looked at some information in Florida of residential properties located close to communication towers. And also, we actually reviewed a study of that Dr. Bond had also done actually internationally in New Zealand on the same issue. But basically, what was determined from those studies was that the only time they actually found any negative impact from communication towers was when there was a substantial amount of negative publicity, media coverage actually covering the issue. That was the only time they were able to determine any negative impact. In the cases where there was no media publicity, or they did the study prior to any media publicity, the information, there was actually no significant or any change at all in property values. And the property values just tended to follow the market. In fact, in the studies they did, the property values actually increased comparatively with the market that was increasing at the time. The other information, another study done by a Alan Doran and a Joe Smith, they looked at, the title of the study was The Impact of Communication Towers on Residential Property Values. This was from the Right Away magazine and was done in the Richmond, Virginia area. And they found that they looked at properties that were located adjacent, communication towers adjacent to residential properties. And what they found was they concluded there was no consistent market evidence suggesting any negative impact upon the property value of improved residential properties exposed to communication towers in this market area. We looked at several studies regarding high voltage transmission lines. Once again, the reason we did that was there's not a whole lot of specific information directly addressing the cell towers particularly, so we also looked at high voltage transmission lines, and it's also an area we have a lot of experience in. But one of the foremost known individuals in this field is William Kennard, and I just wanted to read a little quote from his study regarding the impact of high transmission voltage lines on residential values. And he has stated that the important point remains that the typical individual residential property owner need not suffer any negative financial or economic consequences as a result of having his house near a high voltage overhead electric transmission line. The owner may not like it personally, but as far as general market reaction is concerned, such a property normally is not penalized. There were several other studies that we looked at in that same area. Most of those studies, another one actually done by Mr. Kennard with another individual at a later date, has stated that what really matters is what people actually do when confronted with a purchase decision rather than what they say they will do in an artificially contrived hypothetical decision-making environment. I guess to sort of sum that up is what they found was people's actual actions in terms of their purchases. They found that they paid just as much for properties located adjacent to the high voltage transmission lines as the similar properties that were located further away. And that the oftentimes there was this perceived notion that there was a loss in value, but the actual data did not justify that. Following the information from the national studies, to bring it to a more local level, what we did was a little bit different from what Mr. Trice did was we did a regional sales data analysis. And the approach that we took was we basically researched where all the cell phone communication towers were located primarily in the coastal area from about Rehoboth down through Ocean City and sticking to the resort area. And we then tried to look at the cell towers that were located closest to residential properties. And then we found ones that were basically located adjacent to residential properties, similar to the one that's being proposed here this evening. numerous sales of these properties. We actually found hundreds of properties throughout the coastal region that had sold in the last 5 to 10 years. And we focused on the ones that were located directly adjacent to or had direct views of communication towers. The following properties were the ones we analyzed. I'm actually going to start. We actually looked at Sea Pines Village itself. What we did there was we tried to look at the sales within the project, since the cell tower, the temporary one, was put in place. And we actually only found 2 settled sales that had taken place. Actually, Mr. Trace had mentioned one. One was a foreclosure sale. So since that was not an arm's length transaction, we really did not consider that or put any weight on that. But there was a private sale that settled in August of 2010, and that was unit 25 in building number 4. That sold for $387,500. And we did contact the buyer and discuss the terms of sales and the details regarding their purchase decision. And the buyer indicated that they were aware of the proposed tower, obviously, and that did not deter them from their purchase. They still purchased the property. Actually, it's noted that the sale price of $387,000 was actually greater than the 2 prior sales that had occurred 12 months prior to the tower. There was 2 sales prior to the tower. One sold in January of 2010 for $350,000, and one sold in October of 2009 for $379,000. So even though we were in a downward market where real estate values were falling, the most recent sales transaction in Sea Pines was higher than the 2 previous ones before the temporary poll actually went in place. The other property that we looked at was Swan Cove, and I have I'm not sure the best way to show you these pictures, because you might, if I put them on the easel there, I don't think you're going to be able to see. Can we?
You see it if you hold them.
You think you see if I hold it right?
Hold it.
Okay. Or Stacy can hold it for me if you want her to. Okay. You know. Yeah, just hold it back a little bit so yeah, I can see it. Okay. What Swan Cove is 184, I'll explain this a little better in a second, but Swan Cove is 184 lot subdivision located on the north side of Lighthouse Road, east of the intersection of Old Mill Road and Selbyville. That's Route 54, basically. This is just off of Route 54. The project is, in fact, I'll give you a little bit of a landmark. This is where North Bay Marina and Casual Designs Furniture Store is located. This sits behind that. This is North Bay Marina here. You can see the boats, and this is Casual Design Furniture Store. Located right here, directly across this little storm management pond, is a communications tower. It's a 150-foot monopole communications tower located right here. And these units right here are all directly across with the direct view of the tower. And what we did was, just like Mr. Trice had stated earlier, we did matched pairs, just like he had done. What we did was we compared these units that had sold. We compared them to these units on this side of the development that sold during the same time period. These units on this side do not have any view or any view at all of the monopole. What we found was there was no discernible difference in the sale price per unit of these properties compared to the properties that are located with a direct view and adjacent to the monopole. We actually looked at 5. We did 5 matched pairs on that. The other project that we looked at in the sales analysis was Oyster Harbor. Oyster Harbor has about 250 homes, and it's located in West Ocean City. And it's positioned just a little bit north of Route 50 on the east side of Kaiser Road. It's an area, there's a lot of commercial development just to the south of this development, and it's a pretty densely developed residential area. Also, this is a site right here is the Station 5 Ocean City Volunteer Fire Company's location. And behind the fire station, they had a lattice-style tower that was 150 feet tall. It was their communication tower. These units located right here, it's a little hard to see, but that are located or colored in red, they're right next to the tower. The tower sits right here. That building's actually been, they've actually built a new fire station there that they've just completed. But we looked at these during the time when the fire station was still there and the 150-foot tower was still in place. Once again, we looked at five matched pairs, and we also spoke to the property management company, Mann Properties. They're the ones that handle all the sales in Oyster Harbor. And they stated, we talked to Kelly Quinn, who was the manager, and she stated that the communications tower had never been an issue for property owners. And she had made the statement that most people never even notice it. Well, what we did was we looked at the sales of five properties that were located immediately adjacent to that 150-foot tower, and then we compared them to what we called our control properties. They're located in green, at little green stars scattered on the opposite side of the subdivision away from the tower. And what we found was, once again, that there was no discernible impact on value as a result of the close view of the communication tower compared to the ones that were located away from the tower. The other project we looked at this project is called Summer House, Summer House Condominium Building. It was constructed in 2004, and it's a four-story garden-style building. It's got 28 flat-style units. It's located on 100 Street in Ocean City on the Bayside. This property, as you can see, this is the building right here, directly sitting in front of the building. This is a 75-foot monopole communications tower, but also you can see located next to it is an enormous water tank located right in front of the condominium building along with the tower that's located next to it. What we did with the Summer House condominium building was we looked at condominium buildings nearby that had the same view, same size, same bedroom counts, etc., that were similar. We did, as Mr. Trice had done in his report, we did match pair analysis, and what we found was that the data didn't provide any support and no consistent trend indicating any diminution in value. We found the units away from this tower sold for essentially the same price per square foot as the ones located in the condominium building. Okay. One more. Some of you might be familiar with this, but this project is Sunset Island. Sunset Island is located about 67th Street in Ocean City on the Bay. It's a private resort. It features townhouses. It's got detached dwellings. It's got some flat-style units. And these are very high-priced units. In fact, the highest-priced units go up to about $1 million. And the south side of Sunset Island is bordered by a canal right here. And this property, right across the canal from these units, this is the public works property owned by the town of Ocean City. This is where they store all their buses. There's also a boat storage area here. But right here, this green that's indicated right here, right across the canal from these units, this is a 340-foot tower. It's a tall lattice tower. It's the communication tower. It has all the emergency communications on it. It's for the police department, the fire department, for sort of the town of Ocean City. But if you look closely at this, you'll see the tower, the height of this tower is also a water tower here and a water tower about right here. But that is a 340-foot tower, I mean, more than three times the size of the one we're discussing this evening. What we did was, in this case, we looked at these units right here that are directly across from the tower, and we compared them to the sales of the units that are located all the way down here on the west side of the project on the same canal, all things being the same. Interestingly, this one unit, it's in our matched pairs, that sold right here, it's directly across from the tower, sold for $985,000. It's a high sale in the project, and it's the same size as these others, and as these down here. It actually sold for more than our control properties. So once again, what we found was doing the paired sales analysis of these properties, we didn't find any discernible diminution in value compared to the ones closest to the tower as those that were further away.
And you consider the sites that you looked at as being comparable to the area around the proposed tower that we're talking about tonight?
Yes, yeah, we made sure we stayed in the resort marketing area so that we had a similar market to consider. And just as sort of summarize our findings, basically our research seemed to indicate that the residential property values are not being penalized as a result of being located close to communication towers. Our findings in our sales data was very consistent with the findings in the national studies, and there was basically no demonstrated reluctance of buyers in the marketplace, particularly in the resort areas, to purchase properties that are located close to communication towers.
You also did an analysis of impact on rental rates, is that correct?
That is correct.
And could you explain to the board a little bit about what you did in terms of that particular review?
Yes. We did conduct an additional research to assess if there's any impact on potential rental rates or rental income as a result of a communication tower. We did this through several things we did. We interviewed local resort property management companies, the rental offices, as well as going online looking at rentals. We particularly focused on Sea Pines Village. And based on the data collected, it appears that the rental rates in Sea Pines are very much in line with the other non-oceanfront properties that we looked at. Additionally, we also looked at other rentals and talked to property managers with some of those properties you're looking at. In fact, one of the ones was Sunset Island. We contacted their rental department, and we looked at those units that were located directly across from that 340-foot tower. And the comment from the rental department was that, those are some of their best rentals, and that the owners and renters, this was a quote from the rental manager, don't care about the tower. They come to Ocean City for the location. There was no indication that the construction of the towers or the temporary tower that's currently at Sea Pines has had any impact on the rentals in Sea Pines. We actually looked at when renters come to resort areas, they come there, they're concerned about how many bedrooms, how many baths, what's the proximity to the beach, what's the availability of amenities, how far away are the restaurants, the shopping. The typical renter is most interested in finding a property at the beach that will comfortably accommodate their needs, enough bedrooms and baths. The question as to whether there's a communication tower, it's simply not a question that's asked when it comes to renting a property when people come to the beach. We actually went online and took the one of the interesting things is the rental companies actually put comments from renters. So we looked at all the comments from units that had rented in Sea Pines. We had randomly selected about six units in Sea Pines, all which had done very well in terms of their rentals. And we looked at their rentals from the date when the temporary pole went up last summer, and we looked at numerous comments. People commented on they liked the convenience of the location. People would comment on things like the room wasn't clean, or there actually were some negative comments about that they didn't like being located next to a convenience store. The interesting thing was, in all these comments, we never found a single comment that ever mentioned the communication pole. It was never mentioned in any of the comments at all. So basically, what we found was that the as far as affecting rental incomes, that we found nothing at all from the data indicating that there's any impact on the ability to attract and maintain renters, and we found no reason to believe that the addition of the tower would in any way have any negative influence on rental properties in Sea Pines Village. We found no discernible impact on the potential rental income of residential properties located there.
Thank you. That concludes our witnesses in connection with our application.
Okay. Before we go any further, I'm going to recess the board for about 10 minutes before we start the next part of the